VOA1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Friedel and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, in Afghanistan, boys 12 and older have been back in school for more than 2 weeks. The new Taliban government says it is working on making it possible for girls to do the same. My request to the Islamic Emirate is that girls be allowed to go to school, said Marwa, a Kabul schoolgirl. Islamic Emirate is the term the Taliban use to describe their government. I dreamt of becoming a top doctor to serve my people, my country, and my family, and work in the community. But now it's not clear what my future will be, Marwa added. The issue has become increasingly important as the world waits to see whether the new Taliban government will give women and girls greater freedoms than their past government. Zabihullah Mujahid is a Taliban spokesman. He told reporters in late September that the Ministry of Education is working hard to provide the ground for the education of high school girls as soon as possible. On September 24th, the ministry put a statement on its Facebook page saying no decision had been reached on when girls would be able to go to school. The statement added that work on the issue was continuing and information would be shared as soon as possible. Girls' education and literacy rates in Afghanistan are low compared to that of girls worldwide. But the rates have risen sharply since the last Taliban government was removed by a U.S.-led campaign after the September 11, 2001 attacks. Foreign officials and rights activists have increasingly warned that the education of girls and young women may be under threat. The Taliban, however, has tried to present itself as peaceable as it seeks to gain international recognition for its government. Also, Afghanistan likely faces major economic problems that will require large amounts of foreign aid. Officials say they will not return to the severe rule of the former Taliban government. That government banned girls' education and did not permit women to go out in public without a male guardian. They say rights for women and girls will be guaranteed in agreement with Islamic law. But they have not said when and under what conditions girls' schools will be permitted to reopen.
The recent oil spill off the California coast has environmental activists once again asking for a ban on drilling. while new oil drilling leases have not been given for about 50 years, a large number of existing wells are still being used. In addition, the state is still giving permits for drilling in the waters covered by the old leases. The United States government, as well, is looking to stop selling drilling leases in federal waters near California. But none of the current oil wells will be asked to stop production. California Governor Gavin Newsom spoke recently from Huntington Beach, the city closest to the oil spill. He said the state needs to find a way to close the oil wells, but keep workers employed. He called it the deeper question. There are over 1,200 active oil and gas wells off the coast of California. Earlier this month, one of the pipelines run by an energy company in Houston, Texas, broke and spilled over 500,000 liters of oil. Newsom said the spill created a sense of urgency to end the oil and gas drilling business in California. While many people would like to see it stop, the state economy depends on drilling. It is the seventh largest oil-producing state, and there are 150,000 workers. Newsom said the state needs to stop thinking that oil and gas production are part of the future. This is part of our past, he said. Newsom noted that he is working to reduce the state's oil use by banning the sale of gas-powered cars after 2035. In addition, the state says it will end oil production by 2045. A group called the Frack Tracker Alliance has research showing there are close to 1,200 active wells. About 1,300 other wells are no longer being used. Newsom's government permitted 5 new wells to open since 2019. Closing wells is costly. For example, in an area close to Long Beach, known as the Wilmington Oil Fields, it will cost about $800 million. The state, however, only has $300 million saved for the job. Deborah Sivas is an environmental law professor at Stanford. She called the old oil platforms fragile and noted that many of the structures were built 50 years ago and have reached the end of their lifespan. She said the state is being inconsistent by putting forward environmental rules while also issuing new drilling permits. The problem has hurt politicians for years. Many California voters are in favor of environmentally friendly regulation. But political leaders think cutting oil production will hurt the economy in both California and the U.S. Alan Lowenthal represents the area of Southern California closest to the spill in the U.S. Congress. He said the state needs to make a plan to not only stop new drilling, but to figure out how do we stop all drilling that's going on in California. Newsom said he understands some people may be unhappy with the speed of well closures and drilling areas, but he is proud of the state's work. I'm Dan Friedel.
Imagine you want to describe your day. Perhaps you have an English test that asks about what you do regularly. Or maybe you just want to tell a friend about your day's activities. In this Everyday Grammar, we will explore how you can describe the middle of your day. You will learn about how things that happen in the middle of the day connect with grammar. In particular, you will learn about direct objects, indirect objects, and basic sentence structures. But first, let's explore some important terms and ideas. A noun phrase is a group of words that acts like a noun in the sentence. Noun phrases can appear as the subject of the sentence or in the predicate, the part of the sentence that says something about the subject. Consider this example.
I am eating my lunch.
The noun phrase, my lunch, appears in the predicate, after the verb eat. When noun phrases appear in the predicate, they can play the part of the direct or indirect object. The direct object is the receiver of the verb's action. In our example, I am eating my lunch, the noun phrase my lunch is the direct object. Now consider how statements about the middle of the day might connect with direct objects. Imagine you are telling someone about what you do every day. You could say,
I eat lunch. I drink tea. I call my friends. I use my phone. I take a nap.
All of these statements follow the same basic structure: subject, verb, and noun or noun phrase, the direct object. Now let's explore indirect objects. The indirect object is the receiver of the direct object. Consider the following statement.
I send my friends text messages.
In this case, the direct object is text messages. The indirect object is my friends. You might make any number of statements about midday activities by using direct and indirect objects. For example,
I give my mom a call.
Please note that indirect objects can also appear after prepositions, as in,
I take lunch to my brother.
If you are having trouble identifying direct and indirect objects, ask yourself what the different noun phrases refer to. For example, do the subject and noun phrases after the verb in the predicate refer to the same thing or different things? In our example, I take lunch to my brother. The subject is I, the direct object is lunch, and the indirect object is my brother. These all refer to three different things. The next time you are listening to English speakers describing their days, pay careful attention to the kinds of sentences they use. Note how they use direct and indirect objects. With time, you will master basic sentence structures that will permit you to communicate all kinds of ideas, perhaps about the middle of the day, or about many other things as well. I'm John Russell.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. The 1850s were an increasingly tense time in the United States. Most of the population lived east of the Mississippi River, but more and more people were moving west. As western areas became populated, they became official territories and then new states. The settlement of these areas once again raised the issue of slavery. A law passed in 1820 called the Missouri Compromise extended a line across the map of the United States. Slavery was legal in areas south of the line. North of the line, slavery was illegal, except in the state of Missouri. 30 years later, another political compromise made slavery a local issue instead of a national one. The Compromise of 1850 said people in the Western territories could decide for themselves whether slavery would be legal or illegal. Then, in 1854, Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas proposed another measure. His legislation would also affect slavery. It aimed to make the wild western area known as Nebraska an official territory.
This is the Great Plains. This is open territory. There were Indian tribes settled out there.
Nicole Etchison is an historian. She says white settlers could not move to Nebraska because a government did not yet exist there. They wanted the U.S. Congress to open the area to settlers. Investors wanted Congress to act, too, so Nebraska could support a railroad. Nebraska lies north of the line drawn by the Missouri Compromise of 1820. As a result, slavery would be banned in the territory, but slavery was permitted in the state next to Nebraska, Missouri. Slaveholders in Missouri did not want Nebraska to become a free territory. They were afraid their slaves would flee to it. They felt threatened by the free states and territories around them. So Senator Douglas proposed that the large Nebraska area be split in two. The northern part would be known as the Nebraska Territory. The southern part, next to Missouri, would be known as the Kansas Territory. The senator said that settlers in both territories had the right to decide whether their lands would accept slavery. He argued that the Compromise of 1850 had given the same right to people in two other territories, New Mexico and Utah. And he claimed that same right was meant for the people of all future territories. Douglas noted that in the past, the federal government sought to divide free states from slave states by making a line across a map. He said, dividing up land was not the answer. He said the people in a state or territory had the right to decide for themselves. This right was known as popular sovereignty. Historian Nicole Etchison says popular sovereignty required faith in the American political process.
Stephen Douglas argued that the foundation of American political philosophy is that the people get to decide. The voters get to decide issues, and there was no reason why they couldn't decide the slavery issue, just like they decided any other political issue.
Douglas argued that the Compromise of 1850 took the place of the Missouri Compromise of 1820. The new Kansas-Nebraska Act, he said, simply recognized the fact that the Missouri Compromise was dead. A number of anti-slavery senators denounced the Kansas-Nebraska bill. They said it was part of a Southern plan to spread slavery wherever possible. They also said Stephen Douglas was using the measure for political purposes. They said he wanted to be president and was hoping to influence voters in southern states. Opposition to the Kansas-Nebraska bill was extremely strong in the northern states. In city after city, large public gatherings were held. Businessmen organized many of the meetings. They were angry at Douglas because he had reopened the dispute about slavery. They feared that the dispute would hurt the nation's economy. Northern religious leaders also united against the bill. Thousands signed protests and sent them to Congress. Douglas criticized the clergymen. He said they should stay out of politics. In the southern United States, the Kansas-Nebraska Act caused little excitement. Most southerners were not interested in it. They believed the measure might help the cause of slavery, but they also believed it might lead to trouble. President Franklin Pierce did not like the bill. He feared it would reopen the bitter national debate about slavery. However, most members of the U.S. Senate supported the Kansas-Nebraska bill. It passed easily in the Senate. The bill had less support in the House of Representatives. The vote there was close, but the measure passed. President Pierce finally agreed to sign it into law. In exchange, congressional leaders promised to approve several presidential appointments. Supporters of the Kansas-Nebraska Act celebrated its passage. They fired cannons as the city of Washington was waking to a new day. Two senators who opposed the bill heard the noise as they walked down the steps of the Capitol building. One of them said, "They celebrate a victory now, but the echoes they awake will never rest until slavery itself is dead." The new law gave the people of Kansas and Nebraska the right to decide if slavery would be legal or illegal. The vote would depend on who settled in the territories. It was not likely that people who owned slaves would settle in Nebraska. However, there was a good chance slave owners would settle in Kansas. Groups in the South organized quickly to help pro-slavery settlers move to Kansas. At the same time, groups in the North helped free state settlers move to Kansas. Historian Nicole Etchison says some of these settlers were abolitionists who believed slavery was wrong, but many were simply white farmers looking for new lands to settle. Ms. Etchison says these farmers did not care about slavery, but they did not want to live near blacks or compete with slave labor.
It's that third group of Midwesterners who becomes crucial, because when they get out there to Kansas and they can't get a fair vote, they become radicalized against slavery.
In Washington, President Pierce appointed Andrew Reeder as governor of the Kansas Territory. Pro-slavery settlers urged Reeder to hold immediate elections for a territorial legislature. They believed they were in the majority. They wanted a vote before too many free state settlers moved in. Governor Reeder rejected the demands. He decided to hold an election, but only for a territorial representative to the National Congress. On election day, hundreds of men from Missouri crossed the border into Kansas. They voted illegally, and the pro-slavery candidate won. The same thing happened when Kansas finally held an election for a legislature. Once again, men from Missouri crossed the border into Kansas. Many of them carried guns. They forced election officials to count their illegal votes. As a result, almost every pro-slavery candidate was elected to the new legislature. Nicole Etchison says many American elections in the 1800s had examples of violence, bad behavior, and wrongdoing. But the pro-slavery Missourians were extreme.
It was obvious that there was egregious fraud in the elections in Kansas Territory.
She says population counts at the time showed fewer than 3,000 voters in Kansas Territory. But pro-slavery candidates received up to 6,000 votes. The governor ordered an investigation. The investigation showed evidence of wrongdoing in six areas. New elections were held in those areas. This time, when only legal votes were counted, many of the pro-slavery candidates were defeated. Yet there were still enough pro-slavery candidates to hold a majority. Andrew Reeder understood he was governing a bitterly divided territory. He wanted to warn President Pierce about what was happening. So Reeder went to Washington. He met with Pierce almost every day for 2 weeks. He described how pro-slavery groups in Missouri were interfering in Kansas. He said if the state of Missouri refused to deal with the troublemakers, then the national government must deal with them. He asked the president to do something. Pierce agreed that Kansas was a serious problem. He seemed ready to act. Reeder returned home and opened the first meeting of the territorial legislature. The pro-slavery majority quickly voted to move to a town close to the Missouri border. It also approved several pro-slavery measures. Governor Reeder vetoed these bills, but the legislature rejected his veto and passed the new laws. The Kansas legislature also sent a message to President Pierce. It wanted him to remove Reeder as governor. Political pressure was strong, and the president agreed. He named a new governor, Wilson Shannon. Shannon supported the pro-slavery laws of the legislature. He also said Kansas should become a slave state like Missouri. Kansas settlers, who had voted against slavery, became extremely angry. Soon, the situation became violent.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.